The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so good evening, everyone. I want to start tonight with a short story. And as you listen, try to have a quiet awareness of what happens within you. This awareness will give you something to work with on tonight's topic, which is right view. Right view, for some of you who are pretty new to the practice, is really central to this practice. So tonight we'll unpack it a little bit of the many facets that right view has. So here is the little story. I was about 14 years old, growing up in Mexico City, and I went to the movies with my mother. So as we walked up to the ticket, to buy our tickets, I see in the ticket booth a particularly cute young man with delicate features and long hair. Much to my horror, I hear my mother say, "Señorita," equivalent of miss, "could you please give us two tickets?" The young man politely goes about getting our tickets. I wait for a discreet moment to be able to whisper to my mother, "Mom, it's a man." But she's rummaging in her purse and she says, "What? Speak a little louder. And by the way, señorita, would you have a change for this bill?" So you can imagine that I had one of those faces of teenagers of disgust of having to be with their dense parents. So this is it as far as the story, and I invite you now to just close your eyes and just look and see, how did you respond to this story? It's a simple, short story. And ask yourself, was it for you just an innocent faux pas? What happened? Is the topic of gender a loaded one for you or not? How did you respond as I brought in a Spanish word? How did you respond as I bring out my Mexican heritage? So thank you. You can open your eyes. And whatever was your response, just hold it. We don't need to judge it at all. Now, you might be able to work with what came up as we go along with the talk. But let's talk a little bit more about right view in this particular example. So at its most superficial level, right view, as this example shows, is about visual perception. So my mother did not see clearly. She didn't see clearly the person she was talking with. Right view is about seeing clearly, but seeing is used figuratively because right view implies a lot more than seeing. Right view is about situating ourselves in our reality, and this implies understanding your reality, having a certain perspective of your reality. Right view is also becoming aware of our points of views or filters through which we view our life. My mother clearly displayed a filter as far as gender perception. Delicate features and long hair equals female for her. We all have a gender filter through which we view life. In fact, this one is a central one. Have you ever noticed how unsettling it is when you see somebody and you can't right away tell the gender? But we also have a lot more filters. There is the filter of race, of class, of what we call ableism, you know, you have an able body or not, ageism, and all kinds of other isms. So these filters or points of view are invisible to us. And so unless we come up against something that challenges our views, they are just not apparent to us. So we will look at this a little bit closer later on. But right view also implies to clearly differentiate which points of view are helpful or wholesome and which points of views are not helpful and or unwholesome. We're also asked when we practice right view to know the root, what is at the root of the wholesome and the unwholesome. We also need to know when we practice right view the effects, be really aware of the effects of our actions. And the last main point that we will be seeing is understanding the relation of right view and the Four Noble Truths. So this is just a list that we will see a little bit more in detail. So starting with recognizing the filters through which we view life. I like to think of them as lenses, because with a lens, you're looking through it. As I look through you, I'm not aware of my glasses. But they certainly influence the way I see. So, of course, the challenge that we face with these filters, as I mentioned before, is that they are invisible to us. So when I asked you to consider how you responded to the little story I told you, I asked you to close your eyes. And I did this very much on purpose, because with this practice, we learn that often we see clearer when we close our eyes. This inner investigation in our meditation that is so central in our practice is an excellent way to help us make these filters or lenses or views visible, and to recognize how they define how we perceive and act. So we have views, of course, about the world, and they have a great impact on our quality of our lives. So we can start by asking ourselves, what are the main views I have about the world? For example, I might have the view that it is a dangerous place and therefore I have to live in a state of guardedness and worry. Or one might have a point of view about the world owing me something and therefore I live with a view of entitlement. So I discovered some time ago that I was operating under a view that there was an absolute authority out there containing the truth. This, I discovered too, resulted in some kind of a worry, because I was constantly trying to shipshape myself or see in what way could I match this outer authority. There are also views about ourselves. So very useful to ask ourselves, what views do I have about myself? Am I enough? Do I have enough? Do I perform well enough? So when we begin this practice, a lot of us find out that we have this idea of not being enough. And we also discover gradually how damaging these points of view are, how they hold us tight. And you see, these views, the danger is that for us, these views, because they are unconscious and we don't know they're there, unbeknownst to us, they become beliefs. And these beliefs solidify then into our truth. So we see it is very easy to create views for ourselves, and then we get attached to them. And then the problem is, if somebody else doesn't have what I consider the truth, then we have conflict. I'd like to think that we are not trying to replace wrong view with a right view, but instead we're trying to loosen our attachment to views. So in this practice, we are taught how useful it is to pay attention to the information that we gather from the direct experience. But then we're also taught, be watchful what the mind adds to that experience. What the mind then concludes, generalizes. Because then that's a step already beyond the direct experience. And if we know that we're doing that, then we're safe. You know, we do need to make some kind of generalizations. That's how we learn. But let's be aware that we are adding this extra mental activity to something that may or may not be the truth, may or may not be the reality. I love what Gil, how he expresses it when he comes across this kind of topic. And he says, when I see my mind make this generalization or conclusion, I always add at the end, maybe. That's a great practice to just add maybe. You know, it might be true, but it might not be true. So how can we practice to make these points of view or filters visible? For me, I think it's helpful to start by acknowledging that we all have points of view and that we can't live without points of view. They're part of our human nature. However, can we increase our awareness of their presence? Awareness, how we relate to them. And we can also cultivate the discernment of differentiating between the wholesome view, points of view, and the unwholesome points of view. During our meditation, a wonderful way to work with these points of view is to be very alert. What is it that you think of often? That's a good pointer to let you know where our views are. So, for example, I tended to plan a lot. And, you know, that tells you a little bit about a certain view that we might have. Then another thing that we can ask ourselves while meditating, once you notice a certain topics that come up often, how intense are these thoughts? And where in the body are they felt? Then, of course, we want to, if there are emotions attached to these activities of the mind, can we name the emotion? And then the last one is, can we live, once we've differentiated the positive from the negative points of view, can we live according to the positive points of view? For example, if I have the point of view that this country is all about abundance, Can I live accordingly and be generous? Do I find ways to give to people who are less fortunate than me? So now let's go to another very important facet of right view, and that's ethics. So with ethics, of course, we're trying to discern clearly the difference between the wholesome or the unwholesome. Now, for many of us, this differentiating what is wholesome and what is unwholesome is not such a simple issue. And I want to share with you a quote that I found very interesting that really speaks to our modern world. It's by Bruce Evans, and it's from the introduction to a book called Good, Evil, and Beyond. So I quote, "In the age of personal freedom and the right to self-expression, ethics seems to have been reduced to a matter of personal opinion, social decree, or cultural preference. Concepts such as right, wrong, and good and evil no longer stand on solid ground. And we find ourselves more and more floundering when asked to define them. Are these qualities simply a matter of opinion? Or do they have some reality based on natural law? How do they relate to the scientific world of impersonal cause and effect relationship? In an age when life seems to be offering an endless succession of cheap thrills, who is interested in restraint? Even so, without any clear direction in life, we are faced with problems on many levels. With no clear direction, no guidelines on which to base life, it becomes a shabby collection of blunders as we go clumsily groping from one experience to the next. Even more so when the meaning of life is reduced to a compulsive race to amass experiences for their own sake. The result is a society driven by hedonism, fueled by craving, and plagued with problems. On the personal level, depression, loneliness, and nervous disorders. On the communal level, irrational behavior, crime, and social unrest. And at the most subtle level, the legacy of the present age is a life out of step with nature, producing the spiritual angst which has led to the modern search for enlightenment from Eastern sources." End of quote. There's a lot in this quote. For me, it has been a relief to discover that these teachings offer a guideline to find out for ourselves what is the wholesome and what is the unwholesome. So in other words, we can do it. It's not something way out there. This guideline is neither a doctrine to which we passively adhere, nor a vague, new-agey, woo-woo set of ideas that leave us unfocused and ineffective. So what the Dharma offers us are guidelines to train our mind and heart to be discerning and differentiating between wholesome and unwholesome. And this entails an active discernment. This practice is not so much about faith, but wisdom. This is an alive, dynamic practice that functions like a compass, leading us towards that which is wholesome, resulting in happiness, and away from that which is unwholesome, resulting in suffering. So there's no quick answer. We train ourselves to be awake for the present moment finding the answers first in us, paying attention to the motivation of our thoughts, words, and actions, and being conscious of the effects of our actions in us, so the effects that come up in us and also others. So in the teachings, it is said that if we act motivated by the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion, we're guaranteed to create unwholesome situations and also guaranteed to suffer. So in the simple practice of observing the inner and outer effects of our actions, we can find the answer of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. This knowledge not only becomes our guide, but also results in an ethical way of life, which in turn gives us a sense of safety and well-being and fulfillment. So rather than amassing, as Evan says, cheap thrills, this practice offers us the option of getting off the hedonistic treadmill and its short-lived pleasures and choosing a deeper happiness that proves much more fulfilling in the long run. So as part of the guidelines to develop right view in relation to action, we're presented with a list of 10 unwholesome actions. The 10 unwholesome actions are divided into three groups: actions of body, of speech, and of mind. So the three of the body would be killing, stealing, and using our sexual energy in ways that would be damaging. So these are basic unwholesome actions involving the physical world. Although most of us might feel that we are above these pretty gross transgressions, we might investigate these behaviors also in much more subtle expressions. For example, in killing, do we kill ants? Do we kill cockroaches? Do we kill mice? Each situation needs to be considered anew and decide what is the wise thing to do. I was just hearing a teacher from IMS saying that at some point they had terrible problem with cockroaches at IMS. And they decided that, no, you know, it's like, we're not going to kill them. So they let it go. And soon enough, the cockroaches were crawling all over the dining room tables. And at that point, they thought, okay, we better do something. So they got together, they sat around in the dining room and kind of did metta, you know, loving kindness for the cockroaches. Well, that was very sweet, but nothing happened. The cockroaches didn't go. So then at that point, they decided, okay, in this particular situation, considering every situation, the wise thing to do is, you know, we ask for forgiveness, but to kill the cockroaches. So there's no quick answer for all of these, and I think that's one thing that I really appreciate about this practice. For each example, we are asked to stop and think and consider every single component that is part of that particular reality. The second one would be stealing. So, stealing. How common is it for us to just take a pencil from work or paper from work? We don't think very much about that. But as our sense of practice is more and more refined, we will become aware of it and it won't feel right. And the last one, the unskillful use of sexual energy. maybe we can consider that flirting in certain situations is not very skillful. You know, that's like the most innocent, that's the other extreme of unusual, of the harmful use of sexual energy. But in some situations, it might not be the wise thing to do. I find it interesting that for speech, there are four different categories. So we're asked to be mindful with the lying, with malicious speech, with hostile speech, and also gossip. So four. And gossip, you know, that we can notice how easily it is for us to fall into gossip, right? We're talking with coworkers, and we want to have this feeling of belonging, and there's somebody who doesn't quite belong, and it's so easy for us to begin to talk about them, and that's gossip. So then these 10 actions as a way of, as a guide, as a way to remind us that with right view, we become aware that these actions will cause harm for ourselves and for others. So just briefly, I'll talk about the awareness of the cause and effect of my actions. So in this practice, we are made aware that our actions don't happen in a void, that whatever we think, we say, or we do will have an effect on everybody else. And now even neurology is telling us, right, that even our brain is influenced by what we think. So we might think that allowing ourselves in a meditation to go on for half an hour thinking about revenge, that it doesn't have any effect, but it does have an effect. So I find it important to gain understanding of the whole process that starts with the thoughts. And I'll share with you a quote from the Dharma that I find very, very wonderful, because it so clearly depicts the complete process that begins with the thought. The thought is manifested as word. The word is manifested as action. The action turns into habit, and habit solidifies as character. Therefore, mind your thoughts and its effects, and allow them to originate out of love. Arising from the good will for all beings. And the last facet that I want to talk about is understanding how the perspective of the Four Noble Truths fit with right view. When something goes wrong for us, I don't know if you've noticed, but invariably we first think of, we need to fix it out there. If only so-and-so wouldn't say this or wouldn't act that way, I would be fine. But this practice says, no, no, no. Look inward and take responsibility to your share of whatever is happening. So the teachings of the Four Noble Truths point to how our compulsive desires and our attachments are the cause of our suffering. And the trick I find with this, with the Four Noble Truths in this, with right view, is how do we bring it into our lives? How do we make it so that it's not just a teaching theory that we hear, but it's something that we can apply to what happens in our daily lives? So I thought I would share with you an example of daily life. Well, Yes, we can say of daily life, although it happened in a retreat. But it's a real example. This is an example that a dear friend of mine shared with me, and he allowed me to share it with you. So he was on a month-long retreat with Burmese monks who are known for being very, very strict. And after a couple of weeks of eating only vegetarian food, this strong craving came up for a hamburger. The thought of eating a hamburger was so seductive. And here you are, meditating the whole day, nothing to distract you. Well, the thought of the hamburger kept coming up over and over and over again in great detail. Much so that, as we heard in the previous teaching, that our actions are always preceded by thoughts, my friend found himself discreetly making his way out of the retreat center, on his way to find a joint where he could buy himself a hamburger. So before long, he found a place he could get the hamburger. And he gave himself the pleasure. He sat down, and in no time, he ate the hamburger. And then out of the blue, he felt as if awakened by a sudden cold shower. "What am I doing here?" he heard in his mind. He was awakened from the very captivating dream of the desire of eating the hamburger. Reality, however, had not delivered the pleasure that the fantasy of eating this hamburger had promised. He looked at his empty plate. He felt he was being watched by others, as if people around him knew about his misdeed. With a heavy heart, he returned to the retreat center. He was able to sneak back in without anybody noticing. So he was back and safe. So he thought, "Phew, I can put it behind me. Done. Over with." You think it was over? It wasn't. In the meditation, his mind was plagued by restlessness. There was suffering, for sure. There was something that was not quite complete about this experience. So he discovered that he had the need to communicate to one of the teachers what had happened. As he sat in front of one of the monk teachers, he felt a wave of sadness, of disappointment, and even a bit of shame. He also felt tears coming down his face. So he slowly communicated the story to the teacher. And the teacher looked at him kindly and heard the whole story. And then he just quietly told him, "This experience has everything you need to gain an understanding of the teaching of the Four Noble Truths and the attachment to sensual pleasures." So, what did he learn? So let's look at the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. This person first had to recognize that he was suffering. The craving made him agitated. In the teachings, being under the spell of a desire is compared by being weighted down by a debt. The second noble truth, the causes of suffering. He had the direct experience of seeing how the craving for this hamburger had caused him so much suffering. The third one, the end of suffering. He had to learn that the end of suffering didn't come from satisfying the craving. It was very revealing that having satisfied the craving, he did not get the pleasure that he had anticipated. The end of suffering came when the enchantment had been broken and when he had admitted to himself and to somebody else what had gone wrong and realized, ah, the release from suffering comes from letting go of the craving. So this relief from freeing ourselves from sensual, from the desire of the attachment of the craving, again in the teachings is compared to when we're able to pay a debt, how relieved we feel. And then to the last noble truth, the path that leads to the end of suffering. So he learned how this path, comprised of the eight factors, the first one, right view, the second one, right intention, the third one, right speech, the fourth one, right action, the fifth, right livelihood, the sixth, right effort, the seventh, right mindfulness, and the eighth, right concentration. So this path is not only a guide, but also a protection from our cravings and attachments. This path, headed by right view, teaches us to bring the perspective of the Four Noble Truths into our lives and make them pertinent. So I invite you now to close your eyes and let the word settle. May we practice assiduously and continuously so that through right view, the Four Noble Truths will become the Four Truths of the Noble Ones. So now you may take some time to think if there are any questions or comments.
Hello. Something happened recently to me, and I'm struggling with it. What happened was, on Tuesday is the day that our trash is picked up. And our bins are close to our neighbor's bins. They're far apart, but they're kind of close. And on Tuesday, I saw my neighbor kind of in a strange place, close to it, and I saw him take one of our bins. I said, oh, that's strange. So I came out, and sure enough, his bins were all gone, and one of our bins was missing. Mm. And I talked to my wife, and I said, honey, the recycling bin is missing. And she said, that's all strange. And I said, my neighbor, I'll just call him Joe. I said, Joe took it. Joe stole it. I mean, she said, no, you can't accuse him. That is wrong. It's wrong to accuse him. And I said, but hon, I saw him. It's not, I'm not trying, I just, I it's a fact. It's what happened. And she said, well, no, you can't do that. You had them too close together. And I said, no, hon, they weren't too close together. They were close, but it was clearly not the case. And she said, you know, she tried, there was this idea of kind of putting some shame on me saying that, well, the fact is he stole one of our bins. And the problem is it brings me back to my childhood when I was trying to tell my mother that my father-in-law was an alcoholic, was drinking again. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, no, he's not. And I said, I saw him. And she said, no. And then I had to confront her with the bottle. And at that point, it was her and him both bearing down on me to tell me how bad I was for pointing that out to him. But in this case, I said, I'm not trying to make any sort of value judgment. He just stole the bin. But I struggle. Is that towards the Dharma or away from it?
Thank you for sharing that. You know, there are two aspects to the question. First, there is one that has a lot to do with the heart, and that's the part you shared about being small and having to confront saying this about a relative. I mean, that's painful. So, you know, I think it's good that you're noticing that there is that part, and to that part I would say really be very gentle and compassionate for yourself, that there is something that needs to be nurtured. There is hurt there. So that's the first part. You know, really be very gentle and loving to that part of yourself that still hurts from that. That's one thing. Okay, so now we go forward to the adult who saw this. Okay, so that's kind of like what we were talking about, the direct experience. He saw somebody take a trash can. Okay, now see if you can notice what is it, without any judgment, you know, just like a scientist, what is it that the mind added as far as interpreting this action? What did the mind add? And is there a way that perhaps you could look at it in another way? Do you know what I'm saying? Is the question clear?
Well, yeah. Well, there's the word stole, and there's the word took. You know, and one is this intention of, you know.
That's great. That's perfect. You're noticing. That's exactly the key, right? So the direct experience is this: the neighbor took what is your container. Okay, took. Now, there is a big leap from taking to stealing. It could be, I mean, I don't know what happened, but it could be that your neighbor was completely overwhelmed by pain of something that happened to him, and he completely absentmindedly took that. We all have done that, right? That we are not aware of what we're doing. We're so much in pain, or we're so worried about something that happened to us or to a loved one, and we're not aware we're doing something. So what do you think you could do? I mean, first maybe I should ask, have you done anything about it or no? It's just still kind of open.
Well, you know, the thing about it is there's no way to determine my bin from his bin. They're completely identical. And I felt like talking to him about it would be somewhat confrontational and not really in the best in the best interests of anyone, really. We just ordered a new one, you know. Oh, okay. So I mean, it's gonna be free. It's not like it's you know, honestly, the thing is, I was never mad at him because there was a time in my life where if mine was missing and my neighbor's was there and there was no one around, I don't know, I would have done the same thing. So I have no judgment against him.
Good.
The fact of the thing I struggle with is someone saying, no, you didn't see what you saw.
Oh, I see.
You know,
it's your
fault that he went after this one because they mm-hmm. were too far, they were too close together, or no, it isn't really what you we, you know, he was
yeah,
really taking
I hear
his
you.
Yeah.
I hear you. So, you know, that one I think still is connected with a hurt from your childhood. So mm-hmm. I would say, you know, talk to somebody that you know, like a therapist, or you can just kind of clean it up a bit and address it. But you know, I'm glad that no ill will came between you and your neighbor.
No.
Great, thank you. So we have a couple minutes more. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused regarding the craving story.
Yes.
So if the gentleman would have craved a carrot instead of a hamburger, I'm just a little bit confused. Is it the actual craving of it, or is it because he was craving something that the people who were the retreat center said we're not going to be eating?
You know, that's a very, very, very fine question. Really, the important point here is the craving. It doesn't matter if it was chocolate cake or if it was a very healthy wheat, whatever, cracker, or, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. But the craving, or it could have been a carrot, the fact that there was such a craving that brought suffering, that's the important part. So it could have been something to eat that was totally fine or wicked or very healthy, or it could have been, I want to go see the sunset, or I want to go get my favorite slippers. The craving for sensual pleasures that took him away. We have to think about retreat environment, right? So in retreat, you're there. You make a commitment to be there and to try to be with whatever arises, and look at it and not dash after it, because that's the wonderful opportunity that the retreat gives us, that we are able to just be with whatever arises and learn a lot from it. But he wasn't able to do it. The desire was so strong that it just completely, you know, went against the guidelines that we are supposed to follow in a retreat. You know, you agree in a retreat, you're going to be there, you're going to accept whatever food they give you, and you're going to stay there. And, you know, if you are missing your favorite pillow, well, you are with that. You know, you look, okay, let's see, how is it being with a desire of having my favorite pillow and I don't have it? Am I clear? So the question maybe for you might be to ask, like, how would it apply to you in your daily life, right?
I think that's where I was confused. If I'm
yeah.
at home and I have a carrot in the refrigerator and I crave it, I should be able to, I don't think it
yeah,
should be.
Yeah,
totally.
So that's different. So in your daily life, we all have desires. A ton of them, all the time. And some desires are wholesome, and some desires are unwholesome. And there is right view. There is that wonderful witness that hopefully has this lovely, clear way of perceiving reality and said, Manuel, right now it's totally wise for you to go get the carrot. And maybe you are in a totally different situation, and it's not the right thing, even for a carrot. Maybe somebody's telling you something very, very important, and they are emptying their heart, and they need your attention. And you get up, and you say, I'm going to go get a carrot. Well, they might get hurt if they're in the middle of telling you something really, you know. So that's the beauty of this practice with right view. There's no cookie-cutter answer. Every new situation has to be looked at anew, with clear comprehension. And if there is restlessness, if the mind is agitated, which, by the way, our minds are most of the time agitated, especially with the bombardment of technology, it's very hard to practice right view. So when we find out through observing the body that the mind is agitated, and we have to make a decision, should I do this or not? Give yourself at least a minute. If you can do 5 minutes, great, but at least a minute to check in with your body and to breathe and to decide, is this the wise thing to do right now, yes or no? Sometimes it might even be wise to lie. You know that? In an extreme situation, if somebody's life is in danger, they come to your house, they're looking for them, and you have them in your house, maybe the wise thing to do is to lie. So every situation is unique. Every situation has to be given full attention and consideration. Thank you for your questions. Have a good evening.